This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who help support this podcast with their financial pledge and their ongoing donations. We thank each and every one of those of you who have joined the Friends of the Magic Word. And if you have not, then just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and click on the tab that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word, and there will be a short video that will tell you why it is that we could use your support in order to help keep this podcast going. So we thank all of you who have supported us, and when I'm at a convention from time to time, there are people who will slip me some cash, or if you want to do it through PayPal donation or Patreon, any of those methods are certainly acceptable. And I thank each and every one of you again for helping to keep this podcast going with your pledges and your financial support. Well, this week's episode was recorded while I was at Abbott's Get-Together in Colon, Michigan, and I thought it was important that we finally get together with Al the Only. I've tried to sit down with Al in the past, but it seems like that there are so many things that are happening at any one convention. It's hard to sit down with anybody and chat, and Al always seems to be going in a different direction than what I was going, or I was trying to set up a meeting to chat with somebody else. Anyhow, we finally got together here this year, and we were able to talk a little bit about his career and a lot of other things. It's a fun chat among a couple of friends who have been, gosh, we've known each other forever, and it goes way back whenever Jim Sisti used to have the Magic Menu. And perhaps many of you might be aware of that back when it was a publication that finally was put into, I think, a two-volume set of books that gives you a lot of information about restaurants. And Al was one of the original contributors, and I also was a contributor to the magazine and to the book. And also, he has worked at trade shows and everything else. You're going to hear more about his background as we get into this in a moment. So without me telling you more about Al the Only two times, I will start the episode here now because we go into some detail at the front part of this about Al's background. Please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Al the Only, here on The Magic Word. This podcast really is about friends and people either I have known or people I want you to meet. And let me say, they're not mutually exclusive. It's just there are some people on this podcast I haven't met before because they might be some publisher or somebody on television or something that are an author that their publishing company contacts me and said, hey, are you interested? And so I talk with some of these people and I make new friends, and hopefully you do too as you're listening to this. This happens to be a friend of mine who we've been together as friends for decades. And he is someone who had changed my financial life as far as how to charge for shows and things, and we might have a chance to get into that. Al the Only also and I had worked with Jim Sisti for the Magic Menu many years ago. He is a restaurant performer, a trade show worker. He was from Hamtramck, which is just outside. It's a Polish community outside of Detroit, and then he moved to Lanai. In Hawaii Lahaina, which you have heard, of course, unfortunately had a tragic fire, and we'll get into a little bit of that and how that's affected his life. But he had moved to Hawaii, and I want to talk about when and why that all happened and his move, but also the influences that he's had on so many other magicians. And his name comes up quite frequently throughout the years I've been doing this podcast. And he's also at Abbott's Magic Get Together. He is the person who, first of all, puts together the Open Colon, or should I say the Colon Open, which is a golf tournament each year, and has been doing that for 28 years.
35.
How many? 35. Okay. And then also does the graveyard tour of the Magician's Graveyard Tour, and has also authored the book, which is ongoing as more names are put in the book there as they are interred. So enough of an introduction so you know who he is. Now you get to hear the voice, the man, the legend. Here he is, Al the Only. Al Ulrich, but known as Al the Only.
Ullman. You see, that's why I don't go as Al Ullman. Everybody either mispronounces it or misspells it. Yeah, five letters, U-L-M-A-N. Yeah.
I was talking to someone last night at the over at the Legion, and they were saying, yeah, I was telling them I was going to be talking with you, and they said, yeah, we were doing a show one time, and said, so we had a magician before over here, and I can't remember his name. It said Al, Lonely Al, or something like that, and said, no, you mean Al the Only? Yeah, that was it. It wasn't Lonely Al. But I'm sure you've gotten that before, too.
Yeah, I have. Well, aloha.
Well, aloha to you, sir.
Good to see you, my friend.
And you as well. So you are living in Hawaii.
We're still on the island of Maui.
So tell me about, since your place burned, we'll start with that, about the tragedy that happened just about almost a year to the date here.
August 8th.
Yeah.
We left a get-together last year on August 6th, went to the old homestead in Hamtramck, and on August 8th, we received a phone call from Lori's boss saying, the town's on fire. Mm-hmm. So for 2 days, we were walking zombies trying to make phone calls back home to see what our neighbors are experiencing. We couldn't get through. In the meantime, the phone and the computer just lit up with texts and emails, people's concerns, wondering how we're affected. We've been counting our blessings since, and the biggest blessing is we were not there when the fire happened. Mm-hmm. We stayed in Michigan because of a big family event at the end of the month, so we were going to visit Lori's mom, who's 90 years old, visit some family, and just spend a month in Michigan before mm-hmm. returning. So we were very fortunate. After it happened, we tried to get back home, but the island was shut down. They were evacuating people, but not letting anybody on.
Even people who were residents?
That was a touch and go, and I can't describe that, or I don't have that information. But basically an entire community vanished, completely destroyed down to the ground. And the worst part about it is a historic community. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an area that just built up even 50 years ago. This is the old capital of the nation of Hawaii.
Right.
The Ali'i, which are the kings, they would ride their horses up and down the beach, the shores. That's what was the capital of the nation, of the Hawaiian nation. It was also a whaling village, and basically everything there was built 200 years ago.
Right.
Of wood. Mm-hmm. It was a tinderbox waiting for a fire.
Wow.
And what most people don't know is we have fires constantly during the summer. The mountainsides just get brutally bitter dry.
Yeah, we hear about this well, of course, I started to say United States, but on the mainland.
Right.
As far as all the fires on California.
Well, exactly. Santa Ana, they might as well have a festival. They're going to have a fire every year.
Yeah.
Well, the difference is the fire never came down and crossed the road.
I see.
This time it did. It was the perfect storm. There was a hurricane 500 miles offshore, creating 60-mile-an-hour winds with 80-mile-an-hour gusts, and it was actually sucking the air from the mountainside.
Oh, man.
People say that it looked like there was a guy with a flamethrower just shooting fire across the town. We were displaced for about 4 months.
And Warren and Annabelle's was there as well.
Everything.
That got gutted.
As a matter of fact, where Warren and Annabelle's was, that part of the building doesn't even exist. Mm-hmm. Part of the structure of the building that they were in is just girders bent as if they were licorice.
Yeah. Looked like 9/11 disaster.
I've never been in a war zone. Mm-hmm. But several weeks after, there was what was going on in Israel, and I'm watching the news, and I'm thinking, that's my hometown. Except nobody's dropping bombs. There's no terrorist attack, and everything was sheer rubble. And it wasn't just a fire, it was an inferno. The heat was so intense, it was melting the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So that was our first blessing. We finally got there on the 13th. We thought we were going to take what was left in our storage unit, put it into a pod, move back to Michigan. We couldn't get to our storage area because of the area that was destroyed around it. We couldn't get into that area for 5 weeks. And then we couldn't get back into our home site for 3 months.
Wow.
So everything we thought we'd be doing with a plan of doing it by a certain time just went out the window. And finally, we were able to secure a permanent temporary residence. So we will be staying at least through February. That's when our one-year lease is up.
In the same area?
No, we're in the South Shore now.
Okay, on that same island.
Yeah, we're on Maui in Kihei. Mm-hmm. So tragic, devastating. You never realize what you have.
Until you don't.
And everyone says stuff is stuff. But it's the memories of the stuff.
That's right.
That little gift Lori gave me for my birthday 1 year, that was a magic statue, or the tchotchke I bought her for our anniversary. It's all gone. Mm-hmm. We flew in on the 13th to see what we could do or salvage. And I realized I didn't have a toothbrush. When was the last time you thought about a toothbrush?
Good point.
Yes.
Now, as I recall, you had a cat, too, but the cat...
We had two cats.
And they survived.
They were saved.
Yeah.
The man put his life on the line to save our two cats.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But every, you know, now that we're in this temporary, permanent temporary residence, we can at least slow down, take a breath, and decide what we're going to do with our lives.
So are you in that mode right now of deciding what is my future 5, 10, 15 years from now?
I'm not going quite that far. I'm going as maybe what's
Six
next
months?
Month or
okay.
or at the end of February.
Okay.
If you ask Lori, she would tell you we're moving back to Michigan. If you ask me, I don't want to move back.
Well, that leads me to my next question about why that you. I'm kind of going back now in time
okay.
about the when you had decided, because as I recall, and I've told so many people the story, and correct me if I am wrong, how that you said, I think I could perform magic and make a living anywhere, and you were on vacation in Hawaii when Lori said.
Well, and I'm the one, it was my idea.
You said this,
yeah.
Okay, so.
We were in Hawaii in 84 for a national, I think it was the SAM National Convention
okay.
in Honolulu. But we were just tourists, never thought of anything other than we had just been to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
In March of 99, my dear friend Franz Ferrari was getting married, and he mm-hmm. invited us to come to the wedding. Now we're golfing, so we flew to Maui for 4 days, played some golf, flew to Oahu where the wedding took place, played some golf there. And after a wonderful little trip to Hawaii, we're flying back to Detroit. I'm looking out the window. It's March. Everything is brown and gray. And I looked at Lori. I said, I don't want to live here anymore.
Hmm.
And by that time, roughly 50% of my work, I needed to get on an airplane to get to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not unusual that I was flying.
Now, you were doing trade shows for the car companies.
Everybody.
Too. Everybody, basically.
One week, sacks for concrete. The next week, it was farm implements.
And because you're a trade show magician, you are traveling every place.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And I got that wanderlust in my body.
Mm-hmm.
I get to go places I'd probably never be able to visit to otherwise.
Yep.
I have the opportunity to work with some wonderful creative people, not necessarily entertainers. Yeah, these marketing people are really sharp people.
Yeah.
And I get paid very well.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a lot of hard work, and you're on your feet 8 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
not to mention the three or four just hanging out with the client playing, you know, the personality game of if somebody says do a trick, it's not like a Pavlov's dog where you have to jump and do it,
mm-hmm.
but there's a little bit of a responsibility. And quite honestly, if you think about it, they are honored. Look who we have. This
sure.
guy, we flew this guy in from Hawaii, or if it's regardless of who's working it,
he's expert.
Saying no is an option.
Yeah,
and I have some clients that never ask me to do any extracurricular stuff. Once we leave the booth, you're done. Now you're part of the family. We're going to get something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I've been taken to shows, Broadway shows. I've been taken to shows in Chicago and in Vegas because that's what the group was doing that
right.
night.
You're part of the
staff.
Team.
I have two clients. I just did a corporate in Detroit this last Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
First time I did a party was this guy's surprise 40th birthday in 1991.
Wow.
And even though I don't like to work this week, he called
client.
And I couldn't say no. And
right.
then when he threw the, and then when he showed me the size of the carrot, I absolutely couldn't say no.
Right.
If you do children's shows, you've always got that one little kid that follows you around. And it's not that he wants to learn the tricks, or maybe he does, but he's just mesmerized with you and your presence. The CEO of the company, he's following me around like this little kid. And like I say, I've been working with him since 1991. So it's not
yeah.
stuff he's never seen before. It's part of the business. And
right.
like you alluded to earlier, I've always been about the business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm glad that I was able to change your life in a positive way.
You were.
I don't even, I vaguely remember the conversation. And we were talking about pricing.
Right.
Whatever I said, you just looked at me like, it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And you found out it was.
Well, I was staying with you. I was
The old house in Hamtramck.
Correct. And I had been flown up by my client to do a show. And then when you were saying, if you look at the cost of what they are paying for your expenses, that's more than they are paying you. I mean, to fly up here and the dinner and everything else, that you're earning less than your expenses, your flight and everything. And so, like, you shouldn't be looking at things like that.
Wow. I didn't know I was that smart back then. But thank you for remembering.
Maybe it was Lori then.
That could be too. She's the smart one of the two.
Yeah.
Well, so, thanks for remembering that.
Well, I do. And that, I said, seriously and dramatically changed my pricing structure and my mindset, which was the important thing of a mindset of trying to cross a barrier that I didn't think existed. But going to the trade shows and things, you had learned those skills of stopping traffic through the various restaurants and things you've been working for 30 years. What was that, Molly and Hatchet's?
Carlos Murphy's.
Carlos and Murphy's.
I was their house magician for 16 years.
Yeah.
And then there were other restaurants that I had a long-term relationship with. At one time, I had so many restaurants, I had 14 guys that I employed.
Right.
And I really didn't employ them. They were my friends. I said, hey, are you open on Tuesday? Great.
Were they all around Detroit?
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
It was a chain thing. Yeah.
Well, there were two Carlos Murphys. Both of them wanted me 7 nights a week. I built that type of relationship with the corporate owners. Mm-hmm. And then I think I had a Bennigan's. I had a Mr. B's was a local chain. So I had the opportunity to work 18 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you only have 7 nights available physically. You know, I'd call up the local guys. Hey, and they were very competent, but they weren't stealing my job. They were happy to just have it fall in their lap.
Right.
And I don't know what we were getting paid, but I think I took $5 off the top. So it wasn't like I was playing Mr. Agent.
Right.
They were helping me keep the client happy.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, to this day, I still get phone calls. You know, Al, gee, I remember back then, just like you telling me your story.
Yeah. Well, you probably got a lot of guys started in the restaurants as well, because you knew that they were good magicians, and hey, have you ever worked a restaurant? I got a gig for you, you know, to fill in for me.
Just the other night at Seabock's party, David Seabock, Tuesday night party, I met Mystic Marlowe for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He just went off on how that book changed his life.
Now we're talking about the
Business of Restaurant Magic.
Okay.
That came out in 1984. I mean, it's been out of print for years,
mm-hmm.
and yet every now and then I'll meet somebody that will say, if it wasn't for your book, I wouldn't be doing this right now.
There are just a handful of restaurant magic, business magic books. I say just business. I mean, there are also books that have tricks and things in it, but when I say handful, maybe about 6 books, and I don't know there needs to be anything more written about that, because the rest, I may be wrong, but it seems to me that to get a job and to hold a job, there are certain things that you can follow, and it's universal. And once it's been said, then what more can you say about it?
When I started out, Bruce Poskate had a table hopping book.
Yep, remember that? Had that?
The
little
first
pamphlet
one,
almost.
Yeah,
little
the first one
staple
that
thing.
Really made an influence on me was, it was a black covered book by Eugene Berger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the title.
Don't remember that one.
He actually premiered it at a national convention.
Okay.
Lectured and had the book, and it had to do with restaurant magic.
Hmm. Oh, then, wait a minute. It did have a black cover on it.
Yeah.
That was staple bound also. Uh-huh. I do have a copy of that. Yes.
So, my mentor was a gentleman by the name of Roy Kissel, the amazing Mr. Kissel. He was the owner of Fox Fun and Magic Shop in Detroit. And every time I had an idea, I'd run it by Roy. And every time I ran the idea by Roy, he knocked it down.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I wanted to do restaurant magic. Al, you can't do restaurant magic because we have very strict liquor laws here in Michigan. So if you use anything of a gambling nature,
oh,
they could shut the restaurant down.
Oh.
And what's gambling nature? Dice and cards.
Right. What else you got?
Yeah. So I'm kind of forlorn, but... And I made an opportunity for myself, and I booked the restaurant, and I went on working at it for 16 years. So it's not that he was wrong.
Not just not changing your style or your tricks, necessarily.
No, I was still using cards and mm-hmm. dice and coins and yeah. whatnot. But I started a restaurant. Oh, it was the second Carlos Murphy's that opened up. The first one was in Southfield, Michigan, if you know the geography. And the second one was in Warren, Michigan. The city of Warren tried to close us down.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I was using a law that permitted topless dancing.
What?
I was a novelty entertainer.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And I fell under the category of strippers and exotic dancers. So finally, the management of the restaurant went in front of the city fathers and said, he does card tricks. He's not taking off his clothes, and if he did, you wouldn't want to see it. But seriously, they pled my case.
Yeah.
And so I guess a couple of council members came out to the restaurant, and they bought him dinner, and I entertained them, and they realized that
this
really
is good.
But by allowing me to be there, they had to have this permit.
Hmm.
Which meant at any time they could fire me and bring in the element the city was trying to keep out. that's what the city was concerned about. Oh. Not so much as what I was doing.
Oh, I see. So you now, kept out the strippers.
Yeah. So they fire, now that they have a license to do that, they fire me and they bring in the strippers.
Yeah.
So. Wow. So Roy wasn't completely wrong. And it was the early stages of restaurants. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to know if Chicago should have gotten the star of
starting magic,
magic, yeah. Or if it was New York, because mm-hmm. each of the big cities, and it was a Midwest and an East Coast thing. Yes. It didn't get to California yet. Mm-hmm. At least I don't think so. So I know that there were magicians who sat at tables.
There is the Chicago-style magic, which is at the tables, right.
And then I don't know what was traditionally the New York style.
I don't either.
But finally, it kind of became where you would approach a table. Some guys would sit at the table and then get up and leave. My particular style was to approach the table, visit for a little while, and walk away. Mm-hmm. So, and when I was a kid, the lectures that really inspired me were the business lectures. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to college, I studied some business, but it was the magic lectures. And the first lecture that really turned my head into, wow, this is a business, was the Larry Valentine lecture from Chicago. Ben Tallman was his real name, Larry Valentine was his stage name, and he basically lectured about work.
Okay.
Not necessarily magic tricks. Mm-hmm. And then I saw a lecture by Don Allen, and Don Allen really didn't talk about the business, but he talked about the practicality of the trick.
Yes.
You know, just because you make an elephant appear or disappear, how practical is that? None of us will ever have, well, maybe 1% will have the opportunity to have that type of staging or facility to do it.
But still, those techniques are important that we know.
Right.
The same thing when I teach people who want to get into illusions, you still need to know some sleight of hand because you'll understand the basics of direction.
Absolutely.
And misdirection that can be applied then to stage as well.
Well, I never wanted to do a manipulative act.
Me either.
I knew it wasn't me.
Yeah.
But I knew that if this was going to be my living, I should at least know how to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was taking Chavez from...
Did you ever take Neil Foster?
Yeah.
Did you? Here in Colon?
Here in Colon.
Well, you. How about that?
So I had restaurant work 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
I would do my restaurant gig on Sunday night, jump into a car, get here Sunday night, mm-hmm. stayed at my buddy's house, Jack Barrow's. And on Monday morning, I was in Neil's basement with 2 other guys. One of them was Mitch Williams, and I don't remember who
the third
Mitch.
One was. It was the first time I worked at Magic Castle. We were close up together.
Okay. Well, I don't know what happened. He was from Farmington, Illinois.
Haven't seen him since.
Or Farmington, Indiana. Farmington, I think, Illinois. And they lived in town.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, right after my lesson, I hightailed it back to Detroit and went back to my restaurant work.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys were sitting in Colon. Actually practicing. There is that word in our industry. They were practicing. Well, I was working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would go through the stuff and I would try a coin roll or a back palm. But they were really studying. And after the 10th week, I could see how they were progressing and I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down with Neil and I said, look, I don't want to hold these 2 guys back. Let's take a little break for now. Maybe we'll pick it up in the future. Well, we never did. And one time I'm out to lunch with Neil, and he said, you know, you're one of my more successful dropouts I've ever had.
So, what, a compliment?
I guess. I hope so. I don't know. So the notoriety of being one of their best dropouts.
You can put that on your business card.
Yeah.
The most successful of dropouts. Well, in working restaurants, that is an important path, even if you're an illusionist, to learn against some of those
people skills.
And people
communication
skills.
That's
kind of what I'm getting at, exactly, is you need to know how to socialize, how to approach a group, which it leads me to the question about what kind of approach did you use when you would go and talk to someone at a table or like in a cocktail setting even today?
It varied year as the years went by.
Okay.
Sometimes I was cocky, sometimes I was funny, sometimes I was overboard, sometimes I was laid back. This event that I just mentioned on Sunday, mm-hmm. I basically walk up to a group and I say, good evening, I'm your sleight of hand man. I walk around doing tricks. I sit up, roll over, beg, all the easy ones. Would you like to see one? Sure. And I do the little paws up in the air like a little puppy dog begging. Hey, that's the best trick I know.
Yeah.
Actually, I've been invited by the client's host. Name to do a little bit of stuff. And then I get them into a conversation. And that's what I was doing towards the end of my restaurant career. I just basically walked up to a table, said hi, welcomed them to the establishment, and introduced myself as a sleight of hand man. Not the magic trick guy, not the balloon guy, the sleight of hand man. Now, that may be words that they're not common with.
Yes. You have to explain it?
Not really. But if I walked up to the magician, there's a preconceived notion of what I might do for them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's what he did for Johnny's fifth birthday, or that was the star in Las Vegas we saw. They don't really tend to lean to the stars in Vegas as much as they do to the children's entertainment.
Right.
But the sleight of hand man, now that's, I'm here to entertain you.
So you engage them with conversation before you jump
Long before I do the first trick, I'm talking to them.
Yeah.
And I give them the opportunity to tell me to leave. I would sooner have them ask me to leave at that point than very awkwardly when I'm in the middle of something.
Yeah, saying, I'm sorry, we were in the middle of something, you interrupted us. And
well, I'm here for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
If you have a few minutes and would like to see some stuff, just ask your waiter, I'll be right back. So I keep the door open.
A lot of magicians, myself included, for the longest time would carry a whole magic shop in our pockets. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And have all these bulky things. So this way that you're prepared for everything and you can do a different trick for the whole night. Then you finally get down to where, okay, I'm not going to be entertaining the same group over and over and over. I'm going to different groups throughout the night, cocktail settings. Same thing in restaurants. But however, restaurants, that is a thing. I think you do need to bring some things because there's a table watching right next to you. And they're saying, hey, come to our table next. And they might say, hey, we want to see what you did there, because they think they may have caught the method. And it's like, then if you have other things you're doing that you can say, well, let me show you something else I think you might like even better. But what are your thoughts
And then the other thing is repeat guests.
Yeah.
I used to use repeat guests as my testing ground. Hmm. They already loved me because they want me to come back to the table, whether they were with their kids or without. And after a while, I would just stand there and talk to them. And they felt grateful that somebody paid attention to them when they came in. Same thing at cocktail parties.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to blow a person away with your double lift or undercut or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show some sincerity that they're important, that they're there, that's more than any magic trick will accomplish. And that goes back to the business of it.
Hmm.
We have to, by treating it as the business it is. At a restaurant, it's a family thing. At a corporate thing, it's a client that might be spending a ton of money. But because the host is occupied, they're standing alone with a couple of people from their company. Nobody's paying attention to them. Yet, without knowing it, I approach them, engage them in a conversation, and eventually they want to see something.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that first thing leads to the second thing. What I've learned is shorter is better.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have time for a 3-minute ambitious card trick.
Or reset, 3 minutes of reset.
Right. So you kill them with kindness. You wow them with something quick. After that, you can take 3 minutes or 5 minutes. Because now they're yours. But then there's 100 other people in the room. You really can't spend 15 minutes or 20 minutes with one group. You're not paid to do one show for one group of people. You're paid to mix and mingle. And by keeping it short, keeping it light, you show them your best and you thank them. If you had some fun, thanks Scott Wells for inviting me. And they do, as they're leaving. Oh, Scott, this was the best podcast you've ever had. You should have that guy more often.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? That's what you hear. And number one, you're grateful you had me. And number two, you're already thinking, what else can we talk to him about?
Yeah, what other opportunities? I love that, yeah.
So call into Scott and tell him how much you've enjoyed hearing this.
If you want to hear more from Al, that's right, at a later date. Well, do you treat men and women differently? So when you approach a men's group versus a women's group, I assume that you engage them the same as far as talking with them and everything, but do you, as far as your trick selection for your opening trick?
No.
Really?
Well, back in the day, my bread and butter trick was cigarette through quarter.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had an extremely clever routine. It was your basic cigarette through quarter.
Did you use a cigarette or did you use one of those fuzzy pencils?
No, I used a cigarette. And the cigarette was lit.
Yeah.
I thought that...
Well, that was the way that it was invented, was to do it with...
That's the way I saw Don Allen do it in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
I signed more contracts by that trick than anything I did.
Well, you know, Presley Guitar is one who invented that.
I did not know that.
And yeah, Presley Guitar in Dallas, he used to go to a coffee shop every morning, and he was a heavy smoker. And when he was down having coffee, and he was doing tricks for the waitress and doing something different, and then he would use the coin. And his idea was, he said, okay, borrow a coin. And so he had some change or whatever there on the counter. And then, because he would set the burning cigarette on the coin
exactly
to kind of heat it up,
right,
and then would push it through then
right
that way. But yeah, Presley's the guy who goes back to.
Yeah, by putting the hot cigarette on the coin, it changed the molecular structure of the coin, which allowed the butt of the cigarette to melt through those.
Because of the heat, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the throughout the year, it evolved. I really brought them into this. Mm-hmm. I got them thinking about what else, you know, the cigarette's burning at 420 degrees Fahrenheit. Paper burns at whatever. I even forget the routine now because I don't smoke anymore. And,
right. Nobody else was.
And nobody else does either.
I used to do cigarette through coat. That was one of my go-to routines. Seabrook's routine.
Seabrook's, you know. Absolutely.
Yeah, I did that all the time. And the lines, I mean, they worked every time, and it was just solid.
You can't do those anymore.
Well, it was finally they had smoke detectors, and then people were not smoking. And those who did would not admit it because they're in a corporate setting. So I don't want my boss to know that I smoke or whatever, so it's hard to find them.
So now my bread and butter is Ring Flight. Most people tell you to not to get too close to the audience. We all have a wall.
Oh, I disagree with that.
Well, I did, and I do.
Okay.
You know, start out slow and then get personal. I get personal at the get-go.
Sure.
If somebody is going to remove something as precious as a ring,
right,
regardless of the size of the rock or the type of metal, mm-hmm, you've pretty much got them on your side already.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do something amazing with it, now they're yours. They're putty in your hands.
Do you use their ring for something leading up to the ring flight?
Not at all.
Or you go straight to the ring flight?
Yeah. A very, very, I'd like to think it's a very well thought out routine. There's a lot of psychology behind it. It's not just give me your ring. Oh, look, I'm wonderful. It's gone.
So what do you do?
I'm not going to, I would be happy to do it for you if we had the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not that I don't tip it. I do it every day.
Yeah.
I love the trick and I love the psychology.
But it's a whole routine and you've got some lines and things, I guess, to lead them take off their ring. I mean, that's one of the hardest things.
No, I just simply ask them to.
Hmm.
That's a gorgeous ring you're wearing, Scott. Does it have any sentimental value to you?
You've already introduced your character as being a personable and trustworthy person at
that
point.
I try to.
Yeah.
And they know I'm a magician. They know I'm going to do some sleight of hand.
Yeah.
But now if I can convince them to remove that ring, and a lot of times it's their wedding band they're giving me.
Yeah.
Sometimes they will refuse. Mm-hmm. I said, that's fine. I understand the importance. I just can't sleep with my jewelry on. and some people swear to me they haven't removed that ring since they were married.
Married, right.
So what right do I have to ask them to do that? But sometimes they're spot. Oh, go ahead, dear. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Right.
See, it's. I hate using the word people management. But if they feel comfortable with you.
Well, I lead up to that, which I start off like using linking pins, which are larger, and I talk about them being diaper pins, and people don't remember what diaper pins were with Pampers, and so I kind of, and then after I've done that of separating and unseparating, just with using a soft pin, not the Andrus pin, and then after that going into rubber bands with Crazy Man handcuffs, and there are a bunch of different routines with that, and then I'll say, let me borrow for, you know, like this was, Ed Ellis had a great idea where you make like an okay sign, you use that, so this way that it actually penetrates through their hand with the ring, and so then, or maybe if you have a wine stem, someone's holding glass and you go through the wine stem or something.
Interesting.
So then way that I've kind of engaged them and I need something else. How about your ring, for an example? Would you, you know, and 100% of the time they remove their rings because it's part of the routine and I need that in order to keep this routine going. And once I do that, then I'll use their ring to penetrate a few things.
Yep.
And I do a few ringer routines. And then finally we'll do a ring on wand. And then when they're holding the string, you know, it ends up there. And then once I borrow that, I load the ring flight because I show them, hey, you've got this ring on. My finger, and that was another thing when I get right in their face, because I'll have the ring flight attached underneath, but I will put it on my finger as if, hey, you know, this fits pretty nice, but whenever you curl your hands under, zoom, it's gone, and then it's gone. Well, I know where, you know, it's out in the car, you know, trust me,
sure,
I'll be back in about a half hour maybe, you know, and then, but then, you know, pull it out. So that's the conclusion, the ring flight to that, but that's a whole, like a 10-minute routine there, but the point of getting someone to trust me at that point, it's like, well, yeah, of course I'll give you my ring.
And that's what it's all about.
Sure.
The theory is, if they like you, you can do anything.
Yeah.
You have to get them to like you first. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking about my mentor and first magic teacher, Roy Kissel.
Roy Kissel, right.
Roy taught me effect, not method. And maybe that's why I'm not a knuckle-busting finger flinger today.
Okay.
I'll use a trick deck of cards. Whether they know it's trick or not, they're not supposed to know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to say, here, check these cards out. They should be what they look like,
exactly.
A deck of cards. So Roy gave me the easy way. But by giving me the easy way, I was able to concentrate more on the entertainment aspect. Mm-hmm. I wasn't worried if I got that little pinch underneath the third card from the bottom or anyway, or buckle. So then I had four mentors. Roy taught me the entertainment of entertainment. Ken and Roberta Griffin taught me the business of show business.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Ryan taught me trade show and corporate. And then Jerry Conklin gave me the inspiration that, look, just work as much as you can, anywhere you can. Don't give it away. And that's how I got into school shows. So presently, my life...
elementary or high school?
Elementary. Well, at that time, we were doing K through 12.
Mm.
And after the pandemic... I got into talking to kids about respect, responsibility, inclusion, acceptance. And I don't sell myself as a magician. I'm a speaker that's coming to the school to teach the kids positive behavioral. This is a positive behavioral initiative. So when I do the magic, it's unbelievable to the kids because they didn't expect it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually doing a trade show for a bunch of kindergarten through fifth graders.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using the same principles that Dick Ryan taught me and what I learned being in a trade show booth, how to stop a crowd, how to deliver the message, how to recap. And every time I do a kid show, I call them kid shows. Anybody in the school and show industry knows the work. Right. I mean, there is work. We look down at the kids, the guys who are doing birthday parties. They're busting their butts as much as the guy who's doing the company Christmas party.
Not to denigrate anything that a children's entertainer does by any means.
So,
but when you were saying shows, I just wanted to delineate also that from college circuits.
I've never worked colleges. I've never worked in an amusement park.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I regret not working is I've worked a cruise ship.
I was about to ask you that next. Never done a cruise ship.
And now I feel at this age...
We're over the hill for most of them.
Yeah, we're the grandparents.
we're
the ones who afford the big suite room on the cruise ship.
I'm glad I did it when I did it because I don't think they'd have me back now.
And I desperately wanted to, but I never followed that career path.
Yeah.
When we did the school shows,
there are so many rooms in this house, right?
Yeah. Well, when Lori and I did the school tour in '82, typically at the end of a school tour, you either went on a cruise ship or you went into the 40 miler club, the company Christmas party, the banquets. Well, I went the 40 miler route, but I expanded it to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of going cruise line, I went corporate. That was the big difference. Do I regret not being on the cruise ships? No, but I would have loved to have tried it.
Well, the nice thing about the cruise ships is that you're going to be having continuity of a paycheck
right.
as opposed to a corporate one-off kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Having to resell yourself.
One-nighters is a tough way to make a living.
And when you were working the school shows, was that all stuff that you booked or through an agent? Or
back in '82, we were booked by School Show Services out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Oslin and Jeff Warzak sold the shows actually door to door. They would visit schools and say, here's our portfolio. You can have a dance group. You can have a singer or a musical group. We have a magic show available. So a lot of times schools would buy four shows.
Yeah.
And inevitably one of them was a magic show. We did 340 shows in 9 months in a 7-state area.
Wow.
Yeah.
Say it again, 374?
370 shows.
Within a 9-month period.
In 7 states.
Wow.
And that was Jerry Conklin. He says, you want to learn how to do something? Do it. Every day.
Right.
You know, we're doing sometimes as many as 5 shows a day.
Now, were you doing that because, talking about marketing and planning, because it was part of your long-term plan, or were those things just started falling your way because one thing lined up and then you can change the jib of your sail, obviously, to go to a different direction if it looks like, hey, I think it looks like this is catching on and I planned on doing cruise ships, but that didn't happen because now I've got this other thing that's more lucrative for whatever reason. So how did you
The only thing that really wasn't planned was the restaurant magic. I just kind of walked into that and fell into that. And
it
then
seemed like home to you, almost like a natural niche.
And then actually a friend of mine, James Jason, he gave me the Carlos Murphy's gig. I was working another restaurant and he decided he was going to go to the West Coast. And he trusted me enough that he could leave that job with me, and if things didn't work out, he could come back into town and have his job waiting for him, which was perfectly fine for me. I really wasn't looking for a restaurant career. I'd say 4 or 5 months later, I bump into James at a convention in Missouri, and he says, Al, I'm set. I'm never coming back. And that's when Carlos Murphy's became my gig.
Yeah.
So I took it from a two-night gig to a 14-night gig.
Right.
And the school shows, I did it because it was something available. I'm one of those guys, and I think what really helped my career is I didn't know how to say no. Or I wouldn't say no. I said yes, and then I figured out, oh gosh, what do I have to do to accomplish this? So when I got that first phone call for the first trade show, I really didn't know what kind of tricks to do. I mean, I had a gift of gab, and after watching Carol Fox do the auto shows and listening to the guys who were working the trade shows, I had a basic idea. And the more I did, the more I liked it, even though it was hard work. And the more I like it, the more I realized that, yeah, I got a niche here. I should keep pursuing it. But I, unfortunately, I've always been a one-pony show. When I was doing restaurants, I was doing restaurants. When I was doing trade shows, I was doing trade shows. When I was doing school shows, some of these guys, they'll do a school show in the morning, they'll do a cocktail party in the middle of the day, and then in the evening, they're doing a banquet somewhere else. Well, I'm not that young anymore, nor am I that hungry, so... yeah, just a lot of blessings along the way, a lot of lucky breaks, and a lot of opportunities that I know I've missed. So it's not like everything was laid out on a yellow brick road for me.
Right. Because I see some people who it seems, well, I spoke with Jessica Jane Peterson some years ago.
Oh, what a wonderful lady.
She really is.
Yes.
And she's had just a blessed life that has been almost like a yellow brick road. It's just kind of like, you can't see the next yellow brick, but I know if I step, it's going to be up here there. You know? She just has had a charmed life as far as the kinds of doors that have opened to her. But I think a lot of times you make your own luck.
Well, yeah, it's like, I remember when you started the podcast.
Yeah.
I didn't know much about that. And it was one of those things, well, okay, good luck. It happened because you made it happen. And I'm sure there were some early ones that just really went sour or went left or right. And it's the same thing with our industry. It's the industry. I'm blessed that I love what I do. You know, I've got all my high school and college buddies are retiring. Hey, Al, when are you going to retire? Well, first of all, you need money to retire. And I'm a professional magician. And secondly, you want to retire because you want to get away from something.
Right.
I love what I'm doing. I say my morning prayers asking the dear Lord, give me another good 10 years. Let me do this till I'm late 70s.
I don't understand what retirement is yet.
Well.
I'm 72 and I just.
There you go. God bless you. You know, you love what you do.
I really do. My neighbors, I moved into this community that's an over 55 community, and they got two things I have to watch out for when I'm driving are deer and golf carts. Because, I mean, there are no pickup trucks at 8 o'clock, you know, the streets are silent, and it's just, it's a different lifestyle there. But I haven't been part of the community yet because I've been traveling, going to conventions or, you know, traveling abroad or whatever I've been doing. So I really have not retired, if you will, but I'm trying to engage into the community, and when I'm there, trying to hang out with some of the people in my division, subdivision, et cetera. And they're very nice, and they ask about me, and they know that I'm traveling. And I had a financial planner who had once told me there are three stages in late life. One is your go-go, slow-go, and no-go. So whenever that you have money to from retirement that has that's being given to you from your that you have saved, you take a lot out to begin with because that's when you're younger, you're healthier, you're wanting to go and see things. So it's a go-go for every day. And then it's like slow-go in which that I've already been there and I don't need to go back then necessarily. Like last year, I went to 13 different conventions. I'm only going to six or seven, you know, this year. So I'm slowing down a little bit. And then finally, at some point, it's kind of like, I was talking to Don Weiberg. He's like 86. And he said, I don't know that I
really, great guy.
I'm going to Abbott's and I don't know that I'm going to anything else this year. You know, where he used to be roomed together at the 4F convention and things like that, in which that at a certain point, it's like, no go.
Well, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your listeners. this has not been easy. I just happen to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. My wife, Lori, will tell you how many 36-hour shifts I pull. Mm-hmm. I'm just working on something, and I'm catching that second breath, and I just keep on working until you know, something comes to fruition. Mm-hmm. So none of this, you know, I'm an overnight success, you know? And the kids I grew up with who are still dear friends are like people Bibbick. Like, oh, Jeff Bibbick. He rocks the Chicago Magic Lounge. Right. He owns that room.
Bar, basically, yeah.
Jeff Hobson, Kevin James, Lance Burton, Mac King. None of these guys got to where they are by sitting back and somebody handing them. Oh, sure, we've all had luck in our lives. Mm-hmm. But luck is a residue of hard work.
Like that.
And you don't always get lucky. You know, you know you've got that fish on the hook, and it's a big fish, and all of a sudden the line breaks. Or the fish gets away, and now you go home, you're beating yourself up. How could you have done something different? How, you know...
Well, there are some, we were talking about earlier, restaurant books. And for people who might be wanting to get into restaurants, one of the books I would recommend is the Magic Menu book.
Absolutely.
That Jim Sisti had put out, because he had combined all of the, was it monthly or quarterly? They're monthly, I guess.
Monthly.
That he put out. I say we because you and I were intimately involved with that pretty
for
much since the beginning.
Years.
And a lot of articles.
Right.
I have had several people who have said I've enjoyed reading your articles.
Still to this day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just as an aside, when Jim first asked me to write, mm-hmm. I would sit at my typewriter, write the article, put it in an envelope, and send it to him.
Sure.
Then...
It's the old days.
Then I would type it on the typewriter, stick it in a fax machine, and fax it to him. Then I got this wonderful machine called a computer with a word processor, dual floppy disks, so at least I had a word processor to help me type. But I still had to print it out, put it in an envelope, or fax it. Mm-hmm. And then finally, towards the end of the 5 years, I was just, you know, using that. I would send them on the internet. That, I think, is an outstanding resource because of the multiple amount of talent that gave advice. Mm-hmm. You, I think Lovell wrote, well, Mike Sisti himself, we just pour out our hearts of mm-hmm. what we knew. A lot of people ask me to put out The Business of Restaurant Magic again. Mm-hmm. I believe the industry has changed a lot.
Yeah.
The basic principles that I can teach you are still there. I mean, it's a people business.
Right.
How to approach a table, how to engage a group of people. The hardest thing about corporate cocktail parties mm-hmm. isn't the approach. It's knowing when to leave that group.
I was just talking with someone about that very thing, because it's hard to start a new group.
Yeah.
But it's the hardest thing is to leave that group, because you are now comfortable there.
Yeah.
You've made your nest, and it's like, these people love me. I don't want to go anywhere,
right.
But you have to, and start all over again.
Right.
You know, to get people to love you.
But the industry's changed. You know, that hamburger for $5 is no longer a pound, but it's still $5. And that's an exaggeration, but you know it's a lot more than that. Mm. So I think the mentality of running a restaurant mm-hmm. has shifted. To what point, I don't know, because I haven't tried to book one lately. But it's still going back to the core. Mr. Manager, I have something that your guests are going to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know the restaurant language as far as things breaking and profit margins and this, that, and the other. So I could talk to a manager on a different level than, let's say, somebody who doesn't.
Sure.
And again, I've been out of it for 10 years of the restaurant industry, so I'm sure that has changed. You know, expediting food, what does that mean? And yeah, anyway, the bottom line is we're still the frosting on a cake. There is no restaurant in this world, unless it's a magic-themed restaurant, that relies on a magician to make their nuts.
Yes.
But every restaurant that has had a magician absolutely loves the idea that they're giving something to their guests.
Mm-hmm.
Because after that magician visits, they leave with a big smile on their face.
That's right, and want to come back.
And want to come back.
And maybe bring their friends and tell people.
Well, and that's what I tell them. You know, back in the day, I was their marketing guy.
Yeah.
I had a mailing list of 3,000 people.
Yeah.
So anytime I would be at a new restaurant, guess what? These 3,000 people found out I was here. Now, maybe only 3 of them came to see me, but still, the idea that I had something to offer the restaurant that they didn't have to pay for. But what they were paying for is my time and my services.
That's right.
And it goes back to the original comment you made about charging and building a business.
Yeah.
We have value.
We do, and we shouldn't. I mean, as much as the dirty little secret is among magicians is we would do this for free because we love it, we have a passion for it, but it has value, and we should not minimize that by trying to underbid, which is a problem. Some people go into a restaurant seeing a magician saying, hey, this is the, obviously these people like magic, I'll work for cheap. You know, I can work cheaper than that guy, and they try to cut you out.
And I've never had a restaurant that ever went along with that.
No, I mean,
they've said they've actually showed the guy the door.
Yeah. So we already got somebody, it's not going to be you, we can get out of here. Yeah.
And it's a shame that they have, anybody who picks on somebody else's livelihood is has no place in my book.
No. Nope.
There are so many opportunities out there, and there are more than you can imagine if you just made them for yourself.
That's true. I've got a question that is completely different direction. It's not even 180 degrees, but it is from left field, and that has to do with collecting. And you have collected business cards. Uh-huh. We've talked about this in the past about how when people, how do you get started in collecting things, and it's expensive to collect posters. And I said, well, if you start off with people who are your peers currently, at the time my peers were like Doug Henning, it was someone who was, and so there was, the posters were cheaper then than they are now. Just like at the time, Houdini's were cheap, and now they're expensive. And so, but business cards are always going to be cheap, and people aren't using business cards much now.
No, sadly,
how many business cards do you think that you have in your collection?
At least 4,000.
4,000?
Yeah.
And they're free.
Well, the way the collection started, I was a kid who didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I wasn't buying the expensive books and certainly not the posters, even though, you know, a $25 poster was expensive in 1970.
Sure.
But if I walked up to somebody and asked them for a business card, not only did I have a piece of ephemera, but I actually had a souvenir of my meeting that person.
I have one from Di Vernon that he personally gave me that I'll never forget.
There you go. Mm-hmm. What's ruined my collection is that I wanted to preserve the cards. Mm-hmm. So
I know what you're saying. You put them in plastic folders.
No, worse than that, between clear contact paper.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I ruined the value of the paper. But I have business cards from when some of these stars today were just kids. Mm-hmm. Sadly, it's not the piece of paper. But yeah, and they were in alphabetical order.
Oh, wow.
And they were organized in four different categories.
What was that?
Stars of Magic. So those were anybody who happened to be big shots at the time. And big shots from the past. Mm-hmm. Magic shops. Mm-hmm. A lot of business, pick up business cards at magic conventions. And as I would travel, I would stop in a magic shop. So magic shops and builders. The third one was foreigners. Mm-hmm. People from anywhere outside of the United States. And the last one was Joe Q Public. And that's the largest size of the collection. And a lot of those who were Joe Q Public need to be shifted into other things.
Yeah. It's an ongoing thing if somebody wants to collect that. But I don't know how many people use business cards nowadays.
I don't either.
Because they use a lot of digital.
But the question to you is, what do you do with this?
And we've talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I know you want mine. And no. I think you're in the will.
Yeah, okay. I just got to find a place to put all of my own little, since I've moved and everything.
Well, how many do you have?
I probably got about 500 or so, not many compared, but still a lot.
Well, when I first started out, I think it was Mike Caveney. We're standing here on the street in Colon, and I went up to and asked him for a business card, and you collect these? Yeah. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks after the get together, there was a little box of business cards. And, Mike wasn't really collecting them, and I thought, wow.
How nice.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So after a while, some guys knew that's what I liked, and
started giving you
the wife wanted them to clean out that drawer, and so I'll just give them to Al. Yeah.
As we start to wrap up over here, one of the things, too, that I think is deathly important, and that has to do with death, having to do with the graveyard, because you've written the book again about the magician's graveyard, and you've been doing the tours forever,
since 2008.
2008, seems like forever, and it got started.
It's a lifetime.
It started doing this with Carol whenever you guys were going out at midnight, and how did that kind of get started? Don't, briefly tell the story. We don't have a lot of time.
Duke Stern died in 1973.
Okay.
He was buried here in Colon because he had an estranged wife here and two daughters, but he got his friend Monk Watson gave him one of the family plots. Mm-hmm. So that's why. So they paid for his body to be shipped here. They paid for his gravesite, and because he had worked at Abbott's for a while, this was the final.
And he was living where at the time?
At this time, he was living in Florida.
Florida.
or Georgia. But he was
so the
working
body was down south. So
yeah,
it had
he was down
shipped.
South, okay. And he died in Missouri, in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh,
so Carol flew from Detroit there. A couple of other people made phone calls to make arrangements, and his body was brought here. And there's a lot of stories about his burial and things. Okay, so the following year at midnight on Friday, Carol, J. Marshall, Ab Dixon, and all these buddies would go out to Duke's grave, and they'd start telling Dookie stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this became an annual thing.
And drinking shots?
Well, there were spirits involved.
Yeah.
Some years they were smoked, some years they were ingested, and some years it looked like they were floating around.
Yeah.
I remember one year we blew off a whole bunch of fireworks, and other years we would just light a candle and sit around and laugh. But every year Carol would grab a few kids, teenagers, and say, "Hey, we're going to the cemetery." And we would sit around and listen to these Dookie stories. And the reason is Carol didn't want these stories to be forgotten. His best friend died and
word of mouth passed on the way that it was back in prehistoric times. Yeah.
So this went on. And in 1993, Carol took Jeff Bibbick and me out to the cemetery. And he took us gravestone to gravestone and told us a little bit about the people buried there. 1998, Carol dies. And I didn't think I was qualified to take over the midnight visit to the graveyard, so I asked my buddy Jerry Conklin. He not only worked for Abbott's for a while, he lived in Colon, he knew these people who were buried there. I asked him if he would take over on Friday at midnight. Well, what Jerry did is he changed it from sitting at a gravesite to actually walking the graves. So Jerry told stories of everyone. Mm-hmm. Well, Jerry got to be 80, and it was difficult for him to walk. And in 2000, so Carol dies in 98. In 2008, Hank Morehouse calls up and says, "Look, when you were there with Fox, and he gave you that private tour, he was really passing the mantle
to you."
And, yeah, he said, "Al, it is now your responsibility to continue telling these stories." I was flattered. I was overwhelmed. I was humble. I mean, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's an honor. And that's the way it started. But so the first tour, there were only 20 magicians buried here, and I think I did an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in Michigan in August, it's either humid, hot, rainy, or all of the above.
Right.
Much too long to be out.
Right.
Well, this year, there's 44 magicians in the year 2024. So I just had to cut it at 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And today we actually had a pleasant day compared to years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way the whole thing came to be. But what I found out is once I started repeating the stories, it's not that Carol ever lied, but there's a reason tall tales are tall tales. it's like playing the old telephone thing.
Yeah.
By the time it gets to the fifth person, the story's completely changed.
Right.
So I started looking at it from a historical point of view, dates, places, people. And I started writing notes because I was going to sell lecture notes, make a couple of extra bucks. Hell, I'm flying 4,500 miles to get here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those notes turned into a pamphlet. That pamphlet turned into the first book that was published in 2014. And throughout the years, I have updated it either by a photograph that I added to a chapter or somebody corrected me in one of my stories. That's been the beauty of this book. Mm-hmm. I have had people either give extra information or tighten up some of the information I've already shared.
So rather than the actual people who have died, this is a living, breathing thing as far as people are offering.
Sadly, I have become very close with a lot of families. Mm-hmm. I say sadly is why didn't that happen when their spouse was alive or when their father was alive? So I take it as a very serious responsibility.
Yeah.
I have now these stories are preserved forever with the book. My two hopes are that someday that book falls in the hands of a fourth, fifth generation of that family, and they say, "Oh gosh, this is what uncle did, or this is what great, great, great grandfather did." Or so that's one thing. The other thing is, I hope it's used as a reference book that somebody need. And that one has already come to fruition. I have been called on several occasions to verify some information about somebody who is buried here.
Yeah.
So it's
great. And so it has grown to the point where you're not making more additions as more people are being added to the book, but you're going to be perhaps making a second book, so there'll be another volume.
Well, what I'm doing, the thought that we're going with right now is putting out two editions, a volume one and a volume two. Mm-hmm. And those volumes will never be touched again. But addendums will come out either every 5 years or every 10 magicians. And if I find out that I was erroneous in somebody's chapter, that's where the correction will be written.
In the addendums.
Rather than rewriting that whole first book. Mm-hmm. Because I've had a following of wonderful people who have every issue I've bought. Mm-hmm. And I understand the
idea. What version are you on now?
I think at least the sixth or seventh.
Okay.
So anybody who bought the 2021 version and the 2014, that 2014 is in this, only it's expanded.
Sure.
In the future, there will be volume one that will never change, volume two that will never change. So people aren't wasting. I know collectors want one of everything, but the Joe Q public, there's no reason for them to spend any extra money. And then this is the first addendum, and then if I live long enough, the second and third. And
cool.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you led a charmed life, and also the lives that you have touched of so many other people that we've talked about here that owe their careers to you, or again, just we don't know the ripple effects that we've had, but yours have been tidal wave. They've been very big of what you have affected. If you kind of look back on your life, and hopefully the kind of through this, we discussed a lot of the things that through your life and bringing it up to where you are then right now. And so that brings me to the end about your magic word. So what is your philosophy of life? What do you live
by?
Well,
this might be redundant. Have you talked to Michael Mode already?
I have.
I may be using his words.
Okay.
Michael has turned me on to this mantra. You never know when you're making a memory. That day you were visiting at my house and we were just sitting there like friends and talking openly about everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was life-changing for you. Mm-hmm. You never know when you're making a memory. After the fires, the people who generously supported us financially and with prayers and phone calls and cards, I knew it a lot of people, but I didn't know I had a lot of people that cared. Mm-hmm. Obvious, and friends of mine have kind of put me in my place that you have no idea what you've done for some people because you just do it. And I have, and my God, just, wow.
You're blessed.
I am very blessed. I am so blessed, Scott, with friendships like yours that seem everlasting.
Well, you're taking the words out of my mouth. That's what I was going to say then, too. So thank you, Al, very much. Thank
my
you for your friendship. Thank you for your time and your words and everything. And
always make them
great. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Al the Only. Scotty out.
Thank you, Al. I know that not only am I a friend, but you have so many friends all over the world, and you have impacted so many people in so many ways. And I know everyone enjoyed our chat here today. I certainly enjoyed our time together, and I look forward to the next time we get to see each other, whether it's going to be in Colton, Michigan, or wherever our paths take us. And that goes the same for everybody else who's listening here. I'm not sure where we're going to meet next, but I'm looking forward to our next meeting. And for you to keep up with us, the best way of doing it, of course, is to subscribe to the Pod Letter. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there should be a pop-up there that will say subscribe to our Pod Letter. If not, there'll be a tab and you can go to that and it will allow you to subscribe. And that keeps you up to date on who's going to be on the podcast from week to week and also gives you suggestions from the archives. And also, if we have a contest, you'll be the first ones to know about it. And he had mentioned Michael Mode, and Michael was on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he had offered a few prizes for the contest. And the subscribers to the Pod Letter were the first ones to know about it and to get in on the contest. Well, I think it's going to be a wrap here for this week. Again, I thank you for coming and tuning in, and thank you for your patronage. I thank you for subscribing and sharing and liking and everything else you're supposed to do. So please share the word, the magic word, with all of your friends so they too can be informed, enlightened, and entertained. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that you never know when you're creating a memory. This is Scotty out.